This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. This story has multiple parts. To listen to the entire story in one place, visit talltaletv.com/series. Of Portals and Portents by Leslie Herron. Chapter 15, Olivine. The magic of the Selkies never ceased to amaze Eric. First, it was that old barge master who had helped him to understand his connection to Wraith. Then, Pyra's ability to remain atop the inky swamp of the Dredgelands. And now, this young girl whose casual mastery of magic allowed the three of them to race across the water as though it were dry ground, provided they didn't let go of her hand. Ah, the ocean. Nothing truly captures the pure terror of thalassophobia like running across the top of the open water. Eric never found it as soul-soothing as his brother had. Not with the knowledge of what lurks beneath its dark, glassy surface and churning waves. Ignorance truly was bliss, and he was not often accused of being an ignorant man. He looked down into the pristine, sparkling ocean and felt another tremor of fear ripple through him as a dark shape quickly swam up to investigate them. Thankfully, it lost interest and moved on before he could grab a proper glimpse of the thing. Eric breathed a small sigh of relief, unable to fully squash his internal dread. He glanced over at the king, wondering if they shared the same unease. But the man simply kept his gaze on the horizon. Elias did not fear the water. He had seen far worse in his life than the denizens of the deep. On the contrary, he wanted to marvel at the magic unfolding at his feet, to watch in awe as his boots left perfect ripples in the ocean surface without ever sinking below the waves, or laugh at the inquisitive swarms of small fish that gathered curiously at their presence. But something was pushing the majesty of this experience from his mind. He watched another life preserver float by them as they ran, this one empty as well. He let out a sigh, but shook the other emotions from him. There would be time for grief later. For now, the queen, his queen, needed him. However did she manage to come this far? Needing something to distract himself, Elias looked down at the sulky woman.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
She gave him a quizzical look.
Aida?
Her face fell as he showed no sign of recognition.
Pyra's sister?
Oh.
Elias shook his head. His wife had so many siblings it was hard to keep track.
My apologies. It must be all the excitement has me out of sorts. Did she...
Okay. Ayla?
Eric paused his interruption to glance down and felt his stomach churn.
Are you sure we couldn't have reached the queen from the land?
She frowned gently, looking over at the false king. His kind eyes were filled with dread, and his skin had turned a pasty shade of white.
We are on the land. Or what was land until the waters rose. The camp was on the shore until the ocean swelled again last night. We are still trying to move those that are left during the tide. See?
She nodded her head in the direction she had been taking them. Eric glanced up. A dozen or more ships had been tethered to a large container vessel, this one more massive than the last. The convoy of ships, some metal but most of them wood, had become a floating refugee camp large enough to hold a small city's worth of people. Many of the vessels had been battered by the waves and were badly damaged, held aloft by their titanic counterpart. Moving such a structure would be unthinkable, even laughable in its absurdity of the notion, but Selkie magic never ceased to amaze him. As they reached the compound, Ayla led the way across several decks, then up a makeshift ramp to the main ship. They passed by huddled groups of people, wrapped in blankets or scraps of sailcloth. Humans, Selkies, and a smattering of other races were all struggling to cope with everything that had happened to them. There were even some groups that wore tattered black robes, but all of them looked the same, regardless of their race or religion. Lost. Isla led them through the huddled figures and shipping containers with ease until they came to the superstructure, the tall portion of the ship that normally housed the crew. Eric was surprised when she didn't direct them up the stairs to the living quarters, or even to the navigation deck. Instead, she led them on, further into the depths of the ship, making a beeline for the galley.
"Mother, you won't believe who I found!"
Elias followed the girl into the large room, watching her collapse to her knees near a makeshift bed for a woman who looked gravely injured. Of course, the Queen of the Selkies, not Pyra. As he looked down into the stern face of his mother-in-law, he barely recognized her. Her dappled skin was so pale it was nearly uniform, and the sheen of sweat that coated her face spoke of fever. She was bundled in several thick blankets, but even he could see a large bloodstain pooling from her side.
Tioni.
He fell to his own knees and, hands shaking, reached out for her. With a ragged breath hitched in her throat, Tioni turned her attention to the voice that spoke her name.
"Ah, King Elias."
There was a bitterness in her mouth as she scanned the rest of the room.
"Where is my daughter?"
Elias swallowed hard.
I have something to tell you."
Uncomfortable with this display of emotions, Eric scanned the room for something to divert his attention to. His gaze landed on the fluorescent lights buzzing above him, and he frowned. Those should not exist yet. His eyes moved down along the lengths of the lights to see a group of elderly women huddled together in plastic chairs? But that would mean, no, a third world? His mind didn't even have a moment to grapple with this revelation when the telltale sound of someone being slapped dragged his attention back to the others in the room.
"What do you mean? My daughter is dead!"
Tioni was struggling to get to her feet.
"You were supposed to protect her!"
"Whoa, hang on!"
Eric moved forward, placing himself between her and the king. He offered the woman a placating gesture.
"You shouldn't move with a wound like that. Let me take a look. I might be able to fix it."
He gently guided her back into her makeshift bed.
"Ah, you must be Eric."
The queen's features softened as she relaxed back against the folds.
"Pyra told me how you saved not just her, but her kingdom as well."
She reached out and placed a hand on his cheek, but her face hardened as her gaze shifted to Elias.
"I do not understand why you are with him."
Eric slowly began to peel away the sheets of blood-soaked fabric sticking to her skin. The gash wasn't long, about a 3-inch puncture just above her hip bone. But by the amount of blood she was losing, it had obviously been deep. While there was an unpleasant odor, it was of infection and not something worse.
"Well, the good news is that I don't think you perforated your intestine."
He pulled a face.
"But you have lost a lot of blood. We need to get this stitched before you bleed out."
He turned to Isla.
"Can you go find me some thread, a needle, and a bottle of alcohol?"
Jumping to her feet, the faithful daughter disappeared through the door. Tioni nodded her thanks to Eric and dropped her hand before turning her ire back on Elias.
"You were explaining how you allowed my daughter to die."
"We don't know that Pyra is actually dead."
It took a long moment for Elias to find his words. So much had happened. It was like trying to slog through pudding.
"She is missing, though. My plans went awry, and..."
His features twisted with grief.
"That's why we came down here. We were hoping for a tracking mage."
Tiani's attention was pulled away by the return of her daughter with the supplies requested by Eric.
She watched as he sanitized everything with the alcohol, wincing as he poured some over her wound. But she refused to cry out, even as he slid the needle into her flesh. She shot a glare at the king.
"Do not think me a fool, Elias. I am well aware of what you hoped to achieve in that tower. Answer me honestly. Did your plans that went awry have anything to do with the ocean's rise?"
Swallowing that brief flicker of emotions, Elias climbed to his feet.
"It was an unfortunate miscalculation."
His voice hardened as he looked away, scanning for a familiar face. He was done indulging this woman's hysteria.
"Where is Lord here?"
"A miscalculation."
Tiani winced as she shifted enough to catch the king's gaze, her voice growing cold.
"Because of that miscalculation, you are looking at all that we could rescue from the churning waves. My other daughters are still scouring the sea for any that remain, but my husband is likely not among them."
Elias fought to keep their eyes locked, a tightness settling around him, dissolving into fear and anger.
"He is dead."
"Indeed."
His eyes flitted around the faces in the room. One or two looked familiar, but the rest he could not place. And one near the door glowered at him from beneath a black hooded robe.
"Then what of your armies?"
Baffled, Eric pulled his attention away to slowly look up at the king.
"Dude, now is not my armies!"
Tiani swatted away the tending medical hands to climb to her feet. She closed the distance between herself and the king of Ebra, squaring off her shoulders as she glowered up at him.
"We few are all that remains from the calamity, which sounds as though you are to blame for. And you ask of my armies."
Without even thinking, her hand balled into a fist. Elias caught her wrist before the clumsy punch could reach its target.
"Anger will not solve this situation any faster. I know you harbor resentment for my marriage to your daughter, but I've only ever done what was right by her. And I will find her. But there are larger concerns at play here. And if we do not act now..."
Enraged, Tiani reached out with her other hand and slapped him across the face hard.
"I disapprove of your marriage to my daughter only because you were raised to be an emissary of war. It is all you know. And even now, surrounded by those who have lost everything, you can think of nothing else."
She felt the tickle of dizziness as tears welled up in her eyes.
"Be gone. Whatever aid you could have provided us with, I want no part of. I shall ask no favors from the man who sank my kingdom beneath the sea."
She turned her back on the king and made her way towards her makeshift bed. She collapsed into it with a sigh and placed her hand against her forehead, closing her eyes against the sway of vertigo. Eric reached out, only half aware of what he was doing as he snipped the thread still dangling from Her Majesty's side. Something was starting to dawn on him.
How far inland has the water reached?
When the queen didn't answer, he looked up at her daughter. Isla shrugged.
"The first night, it was about a mile. The second time, several more, as far as we can tell."
The color drained from Eric's face. A pre-industrial civilization relied on boats for the majority of their trade. Even in modern worlds, the largest population centers were coastal. If they had just erased several miles of Ebra's coast, logically the same had happened the world over.
No, that can't be right.
He stumbled backwards, tripping over one of the plastic chairs.
It had happened twice.
Wait.
Three worlds. Two swells. And soon...
He looked at the king, his mind racing into a vortex of panic, unable to find purchase.
That's millions!
Elias stared down at him with cold eyes.
Yes, I know you think of me as a monster. I know you are appalled by my lack of transparency. But need we repeat this argument yet again? The horrors I have wrought cannot be undone, and I am growing tired of your constant hounding. We must move forward.
Eric's mind ground to a halt, finding the target it had been searching for.
I have to go.
He climbed to his feet, his breathing ragged, and fled from the room. Chester looked down at his signature, returning the quill to its inkwell. He was no stranger to this process, having nearly signed the meaning out of his own name in the past 3 years. Danny had read and reread the lengthy contract, closing any loopholes and clarifying any muddy waters, but he still felt uneasy about the Brotherhood's intentions. Charity should not come with strings attached. He slid the parchment away from him with a sigh and put on his false smile as he looked up to Charles.
All right, I have agreed to help you in your quest to locate a lost Ark.
Chester tapped a finger on the blank line below his own signature.
Now please, sign the contract and send your soldiers to help my people.
Unable to contain a simpering giggle, Charles apologized immediately before he reached across the table and pulled the parchment towards himself.
No, no, no. No one here has the authority to seal this agreement. Not I, nor even Miss Ruby, as magnificent as she may be.
He gave the woman a sideways bow.
No, this contract is meant for the Scholar's Hand alone. He is the head of our organization, after all, as you are of yours.
Chester's smile fell flat as he reached back reflexively and scratched his head.
So the scholar himself will sign this?
Ah, I thought you a true believer, but perhaps you still have your doubts.
Charles pushed the contract to the middle of the desk, squaring off the corners so that it was aligned perfectly with the straight edges of the table. He pushed the inkwell to the top right corner and laid the quill vertically beneath it.
Perhaps your faith needs to be reaffirmed.
Our faith is not the issue, Danny scowled. We have already lost half a day's work by writing up this contract, and now you tell us that we have to wait for yet another of your order to make the journey? We do not have time to wait. People are dying.
Charles never met their gaze, but turned to the jewel and gave her a slow nod before hastily backing away.
Our God sees all, knows all, and is everywhere. Behold!
Chester leaned back in his chair, folding his hands into his lap as he watched the 12 hardened Templars follow in pressing their backs against the wall. He shared a glance with his daughter, exchanging a silent expression of doubt. Rolling her eyes, Ruby climbed to her feet and stepped into the center of the room. With a sarcastic flourish, she pulled a small device from beneath her armor. It was black and cylindrical with several dials and buttons. She let out a bored sigh as she reached over and pressed a button on the face of the object. His mouth growing slack, Chester watched in awe as a crackling blue orb began to expand in front of them. It grew, warping and elongating until a rip in the fabric of reality tore open before his very eyes. An aimless wind filled the cramped confines of the office room, swirling papers from the desk and rattling the frames against the walls. The blue lightning stabilized, twining itself into a churning circle around the window of pale, swirling gold. As calm replaced the chaos, a figure climbed out from the spinning colors. The wind evaporated from the room as the open portal became a fissure once more and then dissipated with an audible pop.
Greetings, my students.
The scholar towered over them all, his head nearly grazing the ceiling. His face was hidden behind a heavy gilded mask that bore a carved smile and closed eyes, but his skin emanated a swirling golden glow, causing the gaps in the visage to shine like glittering diamonds.
Over a powerful frame, he wore a simple hooded robe of black and white, trimmed in gold. Plain, yet somehow elegant in the way it flowed over his form. His mouth still open in awe, Chester slid from his chair to kneel. There was a warmth in the room that hadn't been there moments before, a feeling of comfort and familiarity. This truly was a god among men. The scholar inclined his head, acknowledging the gesture.
"Please, you have been through enough. Rise."
When he felt his daughter's touch on his shoulder, Chester forced himself back into the here and now with a purposeful cough.
Forgive my rudeness, your lordship?
He cast around for the words. How did one address God? He had never felt his confidence waver like this before. The scholar held up a hand, gloved in lace, and nodded slowly.
"It is all right, my child. It is only natural to stand before the divine and find yourself at a loss for words."
He took a step forward, observing the length of paper laid out on the desk before him.
"Ah, the Ark."
With an unseen smile, he reached out and plucked up the quill. Dipping it into the inkwell several times, he placed the point to the paper and with an effortless motion scrawled his title on the line beneath the Prime Minister's.
"I am pleased to bring you back into the fold, my pupil. We have much to learn from one another."
He turned to the rest of the room, pausing to admire the stacks of knowledge tucked among the relics of the past.
"Charles."
He swiveled to face the meekest of his students.
"Proceed as planned. Take your Templars and begin the search. The Jewel and I will stay here to help in the city."
"Oh, very good, Enlightened One."
Charles lifted his hands into the air and gave a gentle clap to signal the soldiers into their position.
"Remember, to the east, and should you find the heathen king,"
he spun on his heel, glancing at each member in turn,
"relinquish his soul for judgment without hesitation."
Chester had only a moment to comprehend what was happening in the tiny office before he realized that each Templar was fishing out their own cylindrical devices and stepping into rifts that opened and closed at their whims.
"Where are they going?"
He made to move around his desk, but found the Jewel was on her feet, blocking his path. The scholar turned to face the Prime Minister.
"My followers are setting out in search of my Ark, as we agreed to."
Another set of popping sounds told him the remainder of the soldiers had vanished through their own gates, setting out on their holy mission.
"Were they not promised as a gift to help us here?"
Danny stood defiant, not as swayed by the display as her father. She had served under men who thought themselves above others, and she would reserve her judgment for the scholar's actions, not his appearance. "I do not mean to assume, but even as a god, how do you propose that two of you shall be enough to save our people?" A chuckle like a warm church bell filled the room.
"My dear child, my powers are of the mind, not of the flesh."
He moved towards the single window in the room, pulling back the dusty shutters and letting sunlight spill in.
"The recent tragedy has borne many fruits among its thorns. The invisible walls of the world have become thin and brittle, bringing with it opportunity. Come, behold the answer you seek."
Danny and Chester moved to either side of the living god, looking down at their city. They watched in silence as blue lights appeared all across the sprawling metropolis, each one a portal. And spilling from them were soldiers, dozens of them, pushing carts filled with provisions. Craftsmen were leading teams of horses laden with raw materials out of the gates, and countless volunteers to rebuild their broken city and heal the hearts of her distraught citizens poured out to the cheers and shouts of all of Avis. Chester had never been a man of religion before, at least not of the far-fetched beliefs told from ancient pages. But as tears welled up in his eyes, he told himself he would believe. For the sake of his people, he would have faith.
Oh, I'm telling you, buddy, it's not magic. Those symbols are made up.
Atlas ran his fingers down around his chin as his eyes fell across the chaos unfolding on the deck of their downed airship. Stomping a mighty paw, Barry rattled off an argument of grunts and grumbles. He sat back on his haunches and proceeded to explain to his best friend that, through no fault of his own, he wasn't smart enough to understand what he was looking at. Atlas narrowed his eyes to dangerous slits.
Shut your furry hole! Like you'd understand it any more than I do! I'm the smarter of the two of us!
Barry folded his arms across his chest with a disgruntled huff. He let out several murmurs against clenched teeth.
Just because I fell asleep in mathemagics does not mean I didn't learn anything.
Atlas threw out an interjecting finger.
It was, well, it was simply so rudimentary that I couldn't keep my eyes open half the time. Oh, Connet, you overgrown honey badger. If you're so smart, then what does it mean? Oh, for Theora's sake, can you two just give it a rest?
Atlas turned to look over the edge of the boat to see the king approaching. Elias began climbing the rungs of the rope ladder up to the deck, rubbing at his head.
I thought I told you to come meet us as soon as you got Barry sorted. Why are you still here?
Figured it was best to watch over the ship in case someone tried to steal it.
Atlas shrugged. It wasn't a very good lie, but he didn't really care. He tucked his hands into his robe and looked around.
Did you find a tracking mage?
No.
The king hauled himself the rest of the way over the railing.
Who would steal a ship in the middle of nowhere?
Okay, so no showboating magicians.
Got it. Did you at least bring anything back to fix the ship?
Wailing, Elias pulled the glasses from his face.
No, we were all but assaulted by the Queen of the Selkies.
He pushed the palms of his hands against his eyes, rubbing vigorously.
I was not prepared to speak with my mother-in-law today.
Oh, how did that go then?
Atlas stepped away from the king to lean against Barry.
I've had better discussions with enemies in war councils before.
Elias pushed himself to his feet.
And then Eric ran off. I couldn't find him on the metal ship, so I assumed he came back here.
Oh, yeah. He's been here for a few hours now.
Atlas pointed towards the raised portion of the front of the ship.
But, I think he might be a few coppers short of a fake silver, if you know what I mean.
Sitting in the middle of the foredeck was Eric, scribbling away with chalk in hand as if his very mind had been vomited onto the wooden planks beneath him. Formulas, equations, and diagrams littered every square inch of the front of the ship. Some scribbled out, and others circled and tethered to different equations. His hand scratched at the chalk-dusted beard on his face for a brief moment, before crossing out what he had been writing to start again beneath it. Elias covered his mouth, taking in the pandemonium for a long moment. Careful to avoid smearing any of the incoherent equations, he stepped closer to Eric and placed a gentle hand on his shoulder, giving it a shake.
No, I need more time.
I'm sorry. What are you?
Time is relativistic, therefore malleable when introduced to gravity or speed, which means if I need more, I have to accelerate the displacement to compound not only the force, but also the speed at which it passes the given point. And, yes, more time. But I still haven't solved for the negative mass. Oh, maybe if I...
Realizing his doppelganger was talking to himself, Elias gave the man another shake.
Eric!
The man looked up, giving the king a look of confusion and anger.
What?
Elias pointed at the scribbled mess around them.
What are you doing? What is... all this?
Glad you asked. Eric's demeanor shifted instantly as he sprang to his own feet, clapping his hands in a plume of chalk dust.
I realized that all this...
Hands outstretched, he spun in a full circle, indicating the wider world around them.
Wasn't your fault.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't.
Eric tiptoed over his math to where it had all started. He pointed at several crude stick figure drawings.
I realized, thanks to the Queen, that while you may be incredibly smart, something in our genetics, I think, you are also very not smart.
Elias raised a brow.
What I mean is that medieval and pre-industrial mathematics aren't enough for you to successfully learn how to alter my code to this extent. I mean, sure, maybe you moved the coordinates and changed the dimension of the portal, but worst case, you would have made it way too big and encompassed both worlds.
Elias pursed his lips as he felt a vein throb in his forehead.
Which I did. No, you didn't! What we have here is three worlds, not two!
Eric jabbed a finger at the doodles.
You said that you altered my code while I slept, but the truth of the matter is, your coding was probably so bad that it just gummed everything up enough to cause a delay. I'm the one that's at fault here.
His hands moved to the next crude drawing.
I failed to set an end parameter for the seventh dimension in string theory.
The next image showed nothing more than a small dot with other dots zooming towards it.
I've essentially forced this one dimension to become a singularity. If we don't fix the program, then it's just going to keep expanding, bringing in world after world until everything ceases to exist. Or rather, everything exists at once?
A manic grin twitched at the corners of his mouth.
Kind of like the mother of all black holes.
Elias's eyes moved across the equations, struggling to understand. None of it made sense. He felt stupid and insignificant looking down at what his twin understood so easily. He was not used to feeling this way, and he didn't like it. In the back of his mind, that ever-present tickle grew, promising to make things clear. Perhaps this time he could dip into Ravaria's knowledge. He closed his eyes and cracked the door, just a little, enough for her to show him. The chalk scribbles arranged themselves in his mind's eye into the base code of the universe. Everything existed in layers, like sheets of paper stacked on top of one another. And what was happening, it was like the papers were melting into a singular sheet. His awareness was flung through all of time and space at once, forced to watch as worlds died while others were born, and through it all, the never-ending blue lightning. Entire universes were ripped out of existence, fed into the ravenous gullet of the storm. Elias snapped back into the moment, blinking away the tears in his eyes. He struggled to catch his breath. The beauty he had just been shown was unraveled by the chilling reality of what it meant. His doppelganger was right. This program they had created would devour everything until there was nothing left.
How do we stop it?
Eric pointed to a mess of scribbled out equation after equation over by the port side oars. He scratched at his beard again, smearing the chalk dust farther up his cheek.
I don't think we can stop it. We opened Pandora's box, or set the proverbial genie free.
He turned around, stepping over a swirl in his drawings.
You seem oddly chipper for having just doomed all of reality with no hope of redemption. I said we couldn't stop it. I didn't say there was no hope. Then what do you propose we do?
Eric grinned, tapping a finger against his temple.
Not do, but undo.
Elias's gaze flickered between the Arcanist, who shrugged, and back to the madman standing before him.
What?
Atlas nodded.
Like I said, too much sun.
Choking down the urge to vomit brought on by his sudden cosmic mental trip,
Elias took a steadying breath and reached out, clasping his twin on the shoulder.
You're not making any sense.
No.
Eric swatted away the gesture.
I'm fine. I'm thinking clearly now.
Not really.
Hush you.
Eric moved to the final line in his equation, jabbing at it with a grimace.
I know I can make this work. I know I can. But I can't. Stop rambling.
Eric grabbed the chalk and began underlining each portion of the most recent scribbling.
This right here says we can go back in time. Einstein was right about relativity, but he only ever theorized about the mirror universe, not the multiverse. I just need...
He let out a growl of frustration as he scribbled angry circles around the large blank portion of the solution.
To figure out how we get from here to there, there to here.
He tapped at the answer.
If we can solve that, we can feed this into the machine back at the Infinite Tower, and I could very likely open a rift in time. Then we could go back far enough to remind myself to set parameters.
Elias watched his twin stand with a self-satisfied smile, and he felt his own confidence in the man waver.
Altering time is...
Dangerous and forbidden. You cannot be serious.
Look, I know the rules, okay? I've read every science fiction book out there about time travel. So I'm educated on the matter, and I'm smart. Don't kill your grandpa, don't marry your mom. I know what to do.
Eric turned to his doppelganger and pushed his hands together, pleadingly.
I need to fix this. I need help.
While he only understood a small portion of what Ravaria had shown him, his own meager grasp of the mathematics at his feet left Elias feeling small. He reached up to thread his fingers into his hair, concern settling into his core. He had an idea, but he didn't like it.
I think I know someone who can help.
Not to break up the battle of the brains or anything, but do either of you two geniuses have any idea what's going on to the south?
They spun on the spot, glancing off into the distance where Atlas indicated. Above the treetops, back where the survivors had taken refuge on the ship, flashes of blue light were punctuating the sky. And Elias could just barely make out the sound, but it was unmistakable.
Gunfire?
We thank you for joining us for this chapter of the novel Of Portals and Portents, Book 4 by Leslie Herron in this ongoing series available here on Tall Tale TV. You can find links in the description to where you can listen to all her books and novellas, with new chapters appearing as they are being written and recorded.
And if we take the cosine of x, multiplying it by the exponent c, we have the baseline required to calculate the rate of magical deterioration in Grantham's fourth law. All right, children, settle down, settle down. Atlas!
What? Me?
Atlas? I do not allow sleeping in my classroom. Mathemagics is a very important...
What? I wasn't sleeping.
You were snoring.
That was just the sound of my brain, logging away all this fascinating information, Professor.
Really? Then you won't mind solving for X?
X? 12?
You think X is 12?
Yes?
Damn, that's actually right. Fine. Next up, we need to turn our books to chapter 4.
Damn it, Barry! You were supposed to wake me up if I started snoring! Oh, think it's funny, do you?
Meh.
Well, fine. See if I ever let you cheat off my test again. Hold on. I'm not even supposed to be in this class.